This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defense of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. So I would continue to talk this evening on the question, is God a projection? In The Sunburned Soul, I read, in the 25 years from 1956 until 1981, there has been a slow but constant decline in the number of people in Australia who say they believe in God. In the early 50s, nearly all Australians said they believed in God, 95%. It was an assumed part of life in Australia. But the latest estimate of how many people believed in God was in 1980, that's 25 years later, and it was 78%. We've lost almost one of the five Australians in not yet one generation. That was the quote from The Sunburned Soul. And I thought that was the information I needed, because exactly the same thing, as I said last time, happened in Holland. What would be the main reason? Now, if you would ask a non-Christian here for his main argument against the Christian faith in God, I think he would say the same thing here as I've heard so many times people saying to me in Holland. And that is, when you really come far enough, they will answer with the doubtful question, isn't it all self-imagination? And that's the idea of projection. And because of this, I've studied that question and put it as the title on the lecture of this evening. Is God a projection? Already years ago, I gave a lecture on this question, and maybe some of you have listened to that. Today I would like to repeat in the first half of my lecture the same things I've said at that time, although a little bit with different arguments, and then move on to the deeper laying problem, which is the question, what Schaefer always used, the phrase, how do we know we know? Dr. Schaefer wrote in the book, He is There and He is Not Silent, on page 113, our real problem is not a psychological, it is an epistemological problem. And I always wrestle with the pronunciation of that. And maybe you think, why would we use such a difficult word? But the word simply means that the statement God is a projection leads us back really not to the analysis of psychological feelings, but it throws us back on the question, how do we know that something is true? And how do we know the truth? Applied on God, how do we know that we know Him? That they call that epistemology, because episteme in Greek is knowledge, and logic means the thoughtful reflection on our knowledge. So that is what I want to do in the last part, second part of my lecture. I want to reflect thoughtfully on my own knowledge, and I hope that it will help you in your understanding. But let me first start to explain the problem this evening, because maybe you haven't yet understood fully where I want to talk about. And to make the problem clear, I used already for years ago a well-known parable of John Wisdom. And the parable is the parable of the two explorers. Once upon a time, there were two explorers making their way through a dense jungle. And then suddenly, to their surprise, they came to a clearing where there was a beautiful garden with grass and all types of flowers. And then the one explorer said, Of course, this must be the work of a gardener. But the other explorer exclaimed, "It's impossible. That must be here for some kind of another reason. A gardener could never have come here, because it's in the midst of the jungle." And the first explorer kept to his explanation. He said, it must be the work of a gardener. Now what they did was, they made a tent on that piece of grass and waited until the gardener would come. Then they could see it. But as long as they waited, the gardener did not come. "All right," said the first explorer, "maybe he comes in the night, or in a hidden way. Let's put a fence around this place and put blood hound dogs around it. So then the gardener will be caught." And they waited and they waited, night after night, nothing happened. And then the skeptic explorer concluded, "Stop it, there is no gardener." But still the other explorer maintained his belief in a gardener. And he said, "He is invisible and he is insensible for dogs and fences. And he doesn't make any noise. And he comes secretly to take care of the garden he loves." And then the skeptic comes to the point of despair. And he says, "But what is left of your original claim? What is the difference between what you call an invisible gardener and an imaginary gardener?" And there you have verbalized the problem. What's the difference between an invisible gardener and an imaginary gardener? And there I want to talk about. That is a doubting question that suddenly touches the heart of many people today. All of the sudden, the thought arises, even when we are raised in a protected Christian family, then suddenly this doubt comes up in our heart. Is it not all product of our self-imagination, Christian faith? Now, to understand this question, we should for a moment consider where it came from, historically. It's always helpful when you are faced with a problem, then to try to find the root of it. Where did it come from? When did it start? When did people for the first time start to think like that? Now, the first man who expressed this doubt in our culture, that was the thinker of the last century, Feuerbach. I mentioned his name yesterday already. Fire Creek, I said. And Marx had said, you can never really be a 20th century man when you do not go through this fire creek, Feuerbach. And this man, Feuerbach, came after Kant and Hegel, the main thinkers who led modern man beneath the line of despair. But Feuerbach was their disciple, and he drew some conclusions of their thought world in relationship to Christianity. And he did this in a book which he called The Essence of Christianity. And in this book, he said, once you start from man and his autonomous reason, and you want to understand why he believes in God, he said you should first investigate his unconscious motivation, why he believes in God. And what do you discover? One overwhelming fact. The Christians believe in God because they are poor in themselves, and therefore they are alienated from their own real self, and therefore they project the ideal image which they have of themselves in an existing God. I quote, "Every person has an ideal of himself, but because he is unable to come into union with that ideal image, he projects it outside himself in an eternal being which he calls God." Another quote, "Man strives after happiness and harmony. He finds in himself only weakness, and so he projects an all-powerful God. He looks to himself and finds mortality, and because he finds a desire for immortality, he projects an immortal life in heaven. He feels alone and small, so there arises the desire for a godly father. He feels unloving and searches in heaven a perfect love. And so man gives a character of reality to his own deepest wishes. That what a man fails to be himself, perfect love, immortal, almighty, righteous, holy, he expects from his God. And then another quote, the absolute personality is God as a projection of man's own being. And the most cynical remark I found in his book is, the poor man has a rich God. That's, I think, the most profound cynical statement about faith in God I ever read. The poor man has a rich God. Now here we find the sharpest expression of the idea of projection. The word projection we understand today better than Feuerbach did, because we have such machines like that, a projector. And now everyone knows what projecting means. You put a slide in the thing and then it's projected on the wall. Now even a child knows already that the real thing is not on the wall. The real thing is in the machine. Now, this is exactly what Feuerbach wanted to say. Theology is in fact anthropology. It teaches us nothing about a God who is not there, but everything about the realities in the mind of man. And so he ends his whole life with anthropology, and stronger than that, with hedonism. Man is what he eats. That is a definition of man he gave. Der Mensch ist, was ist. In German it sounds much nicer. But he himself said, I started, my first thought was God. My second thought was reason, and my third and last thought was man. And he even went so far that he said, there is only one God for man, and that is man himself. And he wrote that on his grave. Because on the grave of Feuerbach, he wrote, man is a God for man. Homo homini Deus. Man is the only God for man. Now this is another description of Feuerbach's teaching. And I think that this is what today the man on the street, when he is an unbeliever, can verbalize. And you are amazed what he is saying, because this is what Feuerbach said 150 years ago. Now the second man I want to mention on this problem is Freud. Sigmund Freud. Because Freud tried to give a scientific proof of that criticism which Feuerbach philosophically verbalized. And he wanted to give a psychological proof for that, and he believed he could. And he did, because Freud introduced the whole idea of the subconsciousness of man. He observed how people project images, thoughts, fears that they suppress in themselves beyond in the subconsciousness. And then when you suppress something in the subconsciousness, it suddenly pops out and you project it on your relationships. For instance, it can happen that you meet somebody who have suppressed self-hatred. He is hardly aware of the fact, but when you get to know him better, you realize that he suppresses hatred against himself in his own life. But because he suppresses this threatening feeling and negative feeling towards himself, he starts to think that all people hate him. And indeed, this happens. He starts to think that all people hate him. But do they really hate him? No. But he projects his own self-hatred on the people around him. And he thinks that they hate him too. We have a proverb in Dutch, in the Dutch language, that runs as follows. Like the host is, in the same way he trusts his guest. Like the host is himself, in the same way he trusts his guests. We use it when someone is over-suspicious about the honesty of his fellow man. In that case, we say, maybe you are dishonest yourself. But you won't face it, and therefore you suppress it, and then you are projecting your own dishonesty on your fellow men. Like the host is himself, in the same way he trusts his guests. An example of projection. Now, up to here, we can agree with Freud, up until a certain sense. But what Freud did was, he extended this thought and applied it on all religion. He said, everywhere where man is religious, he is so because he has suppressed his deep need for protection. He has suppressed his deep need for protection and his desire for an absolute authority, even his feeling of guilt towards this absolute authority. And all these suppressed feelings lead to that activity in the human mind which Freud called projection. Man is born with an earthly father, but as he grows up, he discovers that his earthly father, whom he first thought to be eternal, almighty and infinite, in fact is mortal and weak and finite. And once he has discovered that, he starts to project his suppressed need for an infinite father on the screen of heaven, in the existence of a personal God. I believe that this way of thinking has become so powerful today that even where we keep our doors closed, it penetrates our homes, like an old-fashioned London fog. And therefore we should be warned in time, and we should be weaponed to face this question. And therefore, even when it hurts you, or you even feel tortured when you hear me talking about it, then I would say, go through it, because you need to be warned and you need to be weaponed, these two things. And I hope that the rest of my talk will help you in that. That leads me to the next passage of my lecture, and that is, how should we answer this doubting question on the reality of God? Now, I think in the first place, by looking it straight in the eyes. If we do not do that, it keeps nagging in my inside. I remain threatened by the thought that this is so. Like a black cat, it jumps on me on my back. I do not have it straight in my before me, but I'm always threatened from my back. And this is, I think, a general attitude in which we in La Brie train ourselves. If people come up with doubtful questions, it's an attitude that we've learned, that is, we put ourselves first in their, as if we stand in their shoes. So that's the first step. You would say, rather dangerous. Yes, but isn't it that exactly what Paul has taught us in 1 Corinthians, I think now 1 Corinthians 9, verse 19, when Paul is saying, I became a Jew for the Jews and a Greek for the Greeks. To those under the law, I became as under the law, though not being under the law myself, that I might win those under the law. And to those outside the law, he said, to those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, that I might win even those outside the law. Now, in the same way, I would say, let us for a moment become an atheist with the atheists. Although not really being an atheist. But let's for a moment become an atheist with the atheists in order that maybe we will win one. That's what Paul is saying. Now, where do we end? Suppose for a moment that the question, is God a projection, should be answered with yes. Then, when we think through that question and look it straight in the eyes, then we should come to at least, that's the first conclusion, and that is, then we are left behind in a world of matter and chance, without any revelation. But do you know how a world without any revelation looks like? I think they should go to the museum and look to the paintings of Francis Bacon. Dr. Rookmaker put it on the front page of his book on modern art. This is a painting of Francis Bacon. Man caught in a closed system of cause and effect. He always paints people in a glass box. And this man, he painted in a box of glass, caught in a box, but with his hair rising upward and shouting without anyone to hear him. Now that's what Francis Bacon painted. But what the modern painters like Bacon have made visible has been verbalized by the well-known novelist C.S. Lewis in one of his children books. It's called The Silver Chair. Scrub and Jill, the two children who are the main character in his books, two of them, they have received a very difficult command from Aslan the lion. They must move into a cave, and as they descend in this cave in the midst of the woods, they will discover that there is a second world beneath the real one. But it's an enchanted world. There is no life. Everyone and everything is petrified under the spell of the witch. And their task and duty is to search the silver chair. And as soon as the prince will take a seat in that chair, the enchanted world will awake and become alive. But, and this is my point, as they, Jill and Scrub, move on in this world and meet the witch, they start to be enchanted themselves. And then the nagging doubt starts to arise. Isn't this the real world? And wasn't Aslan and Narnia a dream? And then the witch starts to talk to them. And she asks, please describe to me the sun and Aslan and the trees and the flowers we talk about. But as Jill and Scrub try to describe it, try to prove it, they feel silly and they start to doubt themselves, and at the end they say, no, it cannot be true. It was all a dream. And so at the end, they start to believe that everything, the sun and Aslan and the trees, were self-imagination. But then Puddlegum, the dwarf, hurts his feet in the fire, and he awakens out of this enchantment. And then listen to what he is saying. One word, madam, he said, coming back from the fire, limping because of the pain. One word. All you have been saying is quite right. I shouldn't wonder. I am a chap who always liked to know the worst and then put the best face I can on it. So I won't deny any of what you said. But there is one thing more to be said, even so. Suppose we have only dreamt or made up all those things, trees and grass and sun and moon and stars and Aslan himself. Suppose we have. Then all I can say is that in that case the made-up things seem a good deal more important than the real ones. Suppose this black pit of a kingdom of yours is the only world. Well, it strikes me as a pretty poor one. And that's a funny thing when you come to think of it. We are just babies making up a game, if you are right. But four babies playing a game can make a play world which licks your real world hollow. That's why I am going to stand by the play world. I am on Aslan's side, even if there isn't any Aslan to lead it. I am going to live as like a Narnian as I can, even if there isn't any Narnia at all. So thanking you kindly for your supper, if these two gentlemen and the young lady are ready, we are leaving your court at once and setting out in the dark to spend our lives looking for overland. Not that our lives will be very long, I should think, but that's a small loss if the world is as dull a place as you say. Now, I do not think that Lewis ever meant this as an argument against projection. But he meant it to help people to realize, to give them a kind of a shock. I think he used this story to shock, to shake all those people who say, we do not believe in God, it's all projection. But who continue to live as if nothing has happened. I think he wants to shake them up. For them, this story of C.S. Lewis has the same function as most of the paintings in modern art museum. It shows us that there is no alternative without God. Without God, we are left behind with a world that is a closed system of cause and effect, just protons and neutrons circling around one another, without any meaning at all. Indeed, this black pit of yours, says Puddlegum. Okay, but now we are moving, secondly, to the real argument. What to say about the theory as such, that God is a projection of the human mind, judging it on the level of its truth. Now we will take three steps. I'll give first psychological arguments against it, then a philosophical argument against it, and then a biblical argument against it. Not because the last one would be less important, but because I think we should first argue with someone who is saying this on, let's say, with intrinsical arguments, with arguments he can understand because he is a man and I am a man. Now let me first say that there is an element of truth in this Freudian theory. His example of projection in the case of someone who is filled with self-hatred and projects that on his fellow man, that is an example that speaks to me and is a convincing argument. And it's important to study this mechanism of projection, because if God is really a person, why should we not pollute also our relationship with God? In the same way as we pollute our relationship with our fellow man through this, what he calls, projection. I do not call it projection. I think it's better to call it wrong observation, exaggerated observation, associative observation. But that doesn't matter. We all understand that there is truth in this, and that also in our relationship to God, we can pollute that relationship by what Freud calls projection. I could give examples for that, but I don't want to go into that. The real question is faith in God itself projection? Now, what is my main argument against this? My main argument against this approach is that it cuts to two sides, and not only to one. The whole argument depends completely of this presupposition that man has a hidden, suppressed need to affirm the existence of God. That is what Freud observed. Man has a hidden need to affirm the existence of God. But my observation is different. I meet more and more people who have a hidden and suppressed need to deny the existence of God. And I dare to defend the statement that in our society today, there are more people with a need to deny God than there are with a need to affirm God. And this makes the whole argument of Freud like a boomerang. You throw it to the head of someone else, but you get it back on your own head. Because why did Freud not make the same observation as anyone can do? Because you can meet people who have a suppressed need to affirm God, but you can meet at least so many people, if not more, who have a suppressed need to deny God. Why did he not make that last observation? Could it maybe be because he suppressed his own need to deny God, and therefore created this whole theory of projection? Now you should listen. I put it as a question mark. only as a question, because I do not want to argue on this level of having a need or not having a need for God. I do not want to argue on this level of what I consciously or unconsciously suppressed or not suppressed feel inside of me, on what Schaefer calls a psychological level. We do not want to talk on a psychological level on truth. And therefore, I only did put it as a question, because I do not want to have it as an argument against Freud, but I only dare to question his whole mentality. Why not? And why do I not want to use this as an argument? Well, because I think it's a wrong approach to our fellow man when we do not listen to what he is saying, but only observe how or why he is saying something. And you should listen sharp, because it's, I think, important. You can never use the why or the how as an argument to deny the what of someone is saying. It's even impossible to argue from a suppressed need or an unconscious need to the conclusion that if you suppress a need for something, therefore the object you need cannot exist, because it's projection. And why this is a wrong way of reasoning, I'll explain with a little example which I thought out myself when I came here in Australia. And I thought, well, imagine that I would get homesick in a week. Now, what would happen if I get homesick next week? Now, because that looks very silly, to be depressed after having been away from my wife and children for only 1 week, I suppress, of course, this homesickness. But the symptoms of this illness increase, and so I decide to go to a psychiatrist. And now this Australian psychiatrist happens to be a Freudian. And of course he helps me immediately to discover my suppressed longing for my wife and children. But would it not be amazing if he would tell me at the same time I must stop to project because there is no one there in Holland? Yeah, but this is literally what Feuerbach said. I quote Feuerbach: "Man gives a character of reality to his deepest wishes. It is an illusion to think that the object of his speculation is not his own self, but another, a godly self." You see what he did? Now, I hope that I made sufficiently clear with that one example of homesickness that this way of reasoning leads to absurdity. You cannot conclude from any need, in whatever form it exists, to the denial of God's existence. The how and the why we believe things can never be used as an argument against the what we believe. And that is an argument on a psychological level with the same kind of observation against Freud. Now the second thing, and that is a philosophical argument. And that is, there is always a hidden philosophy behind this psychological criticism on religion. There is always a hidden philosophy behind it. And that hidden philosophy consists of unproven prejudices. And the unproven prejudices is that the reality is a reality where God doesn't exist, and which therefore consists of a two-fold reality, two layers, divided into two aspects. There is an objective outer world, where everything works after the law of cause and effect, a closed system of cause and effect, and there is the subjective inner world. Man in his subjectivity, and now man in his subjectivity must give meaning to the meaningless objective outer world. And this way of thinking has deeply penetrated the mind of the Western man since Descartes, where Udo have talked about. since Descartes and after the Enlightenment, man in Western man in our society lives in that dichotomy. So that's how Schaeffer calls it. He calls it a dichotomy, an upper story and a lower story. The upper story being the physical world, the lower story, the one aspect, being the physical world, the mechanical world, which functions according to the law of cause and effect. But then the other story, the higher one, there we have to give subjective meaning to the outer world. And in this philosophical worldview fits the whole theory of projection. But it is based on unproven prejudices. And I don't want to go further into this now, because you can find that much wider in the book The God Who Is There, written by Dr. Schaeffer. And therefore I move on now to the third counter-argument, and that's the biblical one. What do we discover in the Bible when we study the Word of God, thinking of this whole idea of projection? Two things. Two amazing things. First is, the Christian faith is never based on emotional feelings or suppressed desires. Quite contrary, the Christian faith is based on historic facts in which God has revealed himself to us. I can prove you that from the whole Bible. And the second thing we discover in the Bible is, the Bible itself hates nothing so much as when man creates himself, projects himself, an image of God on the screen of heaven. Now, both statements I want to explain a little bit wider. And the second one first. If you take your Bible, you will discover, and we read it this morning, you will discover that the whole second commandment is a commandment directed against any form of projection. I believe the second commandment is the best word from the Old Testament against this theory of projection. Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image. In Deuteronomy 4, verse 15, Moses said, take good heed of yourself. You saw no form on the day that the Lord spoke to you at Horeb, out of the midst of fire. Therefore, do not make any graven image for yourself. You see what the Lord is saying? Their faith should be based on not what they felt in themselves about God, that is true, but on the fact of God's self-revelation on Horeb. That's where Moses is talking about. And they are forbidden to do what in the theory of projection is presupposed, and that is to take anything out of the creation and make it to their God. And in Psalm 50, this is applied on mental images, also mental images. In Psalm 50, God rebukes Israel that they have made a mental image of God. A mental image that came forth out of their own needs. And they've made a mental image instead of truly answering on God's revelation. And the mental image they made in Psalm 50, if you read the psalm as a whole, we can't do it now because it takes too much time, but if you would do it, then you would discover that the image that the Israelites had of God in Psalm 50 is that God would be a kind of a merchant. We give him something, and then he gives us something back, so we can make a deal. Now, there is nothing that the Lord hates so much than this. He said, you imagined, and there you have the word self-imagination, you imagined that I was one like yourselves. But now I rebuke you, and I lay the charge before you. Now that's Psalm 50. And this ends the first biblical argument. In the second place, I want to read from the New Testament. Now when you take the New Testament, I could quote so many passages that illustrate clearly that the Christian faith is not based on emotion, but on that what we have seen and what we have heard. That is what we proclaim to you. I quote now the first letter of John. Right in the beginning of his first letter, John is saying that several times, that which was from the beginning, which we have heard with our ears, which we have seen with our eyes, which we have looked upon and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, and then he repeats that again, and we saw it and we testify it to you. That what we have seen, verse 3, that's the third time that he's saying it, that what we have seen and heard, that's what we proclaim to you, so that you may have fellowship with us. And the same thing is, we find the same thing in the letters of Peter. I think now especially of 2 Peter 1, verse 16. The second letter of Peter, chapter 1, verse 16, there Peter is saying the same things. For we did not follow cleverly devised myth. You could say we didn't follow projections of the human mind when we made known to you the power and the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of His Majesty. So there again, this emphasis on that they were eyewitnesses of facts which they have seen. Now, I always think that Luke, in the way he wrote his gospel, and especially the last chapter 24, that he must have wrestled with doubts like we talk about this evening. And maybe he did, because he wrote to a Greek man, Theophilus. It's the only gospel that's clearly written for a non-Christian, or for the Greek world. And now, when you read Luke 24, it's amazing that Luke emphasizes so much that when Jesus was risen from the dead, that all the disciples and the people of Emmaus, the disciples that went to Emmaus, and Peter, that none of them, when they heard this good news for the first time, said, "Oh, that's exactly what I wanted to hear, and so let me believe it." The opposite happens when the women came from the grave and when they told the good news that the Lord was risen, then they say literally, and they did not believe them because these words seemed to them an idle tale. And I think that they must have thought these women were projecting. They walked early in the morning to the grave. And of course they had a suppressed desire to see Jesus, and then they saw the open grave, and then they hallucinated. That is what the disciple thought. And what convinced them? What convinced them so that they really believed? The only thing that convinced them was that they really saw him. And when they saw him, they still thought it was a ghost. And then he said, "But then you have something to eat?" And they gave him something to eat. And he ate before their eyes, fish and bread. And then their eyes were opened. And it's very clear in Luke 24, both for the disciples and for the disciples who went to Emmaus, and for Peter and the whole group of disciples coming together, that they were convinced by the fact of Jesus being there. And that historic fact of the resurrection, that's what they witnessed. And this was so important for the disciples, and for instance, now to quote another man, Paul, that he based the whole gospel on this message of the eyewitnesses. I think now of 1 Corinthians 15, where Paul is saying that the whole message of the resurrection is based on that what these disciples saw one time, more than 500 at the same time. And then he adds, of whom many are still alive. It's a strange addition, because he wants to say, if you want to verify it, go to them. You can hear it. And therefore, the whole New Testament is making clear that the Christian faith is based on that what is proclaimed to be true, and what the eyewitnesses have seen and heard, and what they communicate to us, and not a suppressed need. Now, these were my three basic arguments against the theory of projection. You remember that more psychological one, and then the one on the hidden presuppositions, the philosophical one, and then the third one, these two basic biblical arguments. Now, I want to come now at the end to the more positive exposition on what is now a sound epistemology. How do I know the Bible is true and God being really there? Now, I don't want to talk about that this evening academically. I thought about this as a question that you that any one of you would ask me personally. And imagine that someone would ask to me, and maybe you can think about an answer on the same question. Someone comes up to you and asks, how do I know that the Bible is true and that God is really there? Now, if someone would ask this question to me, I would first answer with another question, and that is, did you ever read the Bible? And it may sound strange, but a lot of people want to have first an absolute proof that the Bible is true, and then they are willing to read it. Now, that is an impossible attitude, because, point one, the Bible carries its evidence of truth in itself. It's only in reading, actually reading the Word of God, or listening to it, that we can hear God speaking. I talked about this 2 days ago on the university. It is not so that we as men, with our autonomous reason, first set up a standard of who God is and how he should be, and then we start to measure him according to our standard. I could explain that with how we get married. When you think about how you get married, then it's not true that you first put up a standard and you say, you verbalize 10 conditions, 10 characteristics of the wife you want to marry, and then you meet one after another and you think, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then when you have the one that fits in all the criteria, then you accept her. That's not how it works. But how does it work? Now, I can tell it very simply. As we communicate with somebody, we fall in love. That's the whole secret. Now, the same thing is true for our relationship with God. And therefore, point one, as we read the scriptures, we fall in love. As we read the scriptures, God speaks to us. And so the Bible carries, in a way, its evidence in itself. Is that a matter of pure feeling, which my word falling in love might suggest, that it's a matter of pure feeling and experience? No, it's also a matter of reason. A good marriage should be too. But when Paul went to Berea, we read that in Acts 17, when Paul went to Berea in Acts, we read that he preached the gospel by actually reading the scriptures with them. But then a remarkable thing is added. They received the word with all eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. Now, that's the first cornerstone to come to the knowledge of God. You could say the consistency of the biblical teaching. It is solid enough to be examined. It's not irrational. It's a system of teaching that has a remarkable unity and a coherence, which is the more remarkable because it's a book written over a period of 1400 years at least. Now, as we do this, actually reading the scriptures reasonably, also emotionally, honestly, the Lord will speak to us. We will get to know him. The second point of each sound epistemology has been exposed by Jerem yesterday, so I have an easy job this evening. We do not only listen to the Bible and examine its integrity, but we apply also the truth of it on the reality which is there. Is it true to what is really there? The universe, our human existence, and the history of man, with all which is that is included. In Romans 1-3, Paul teaches us how to do that. And because Jerem has taught us yesterday clearly in these 6 points, the evidence is, I can now move on. But this is a main point. We may look for the evidence of the truth of the scriptures in the world outside us, whether it is true to what is there. Then thirdly, now, and finally, I come to the question, having done both of these, how do I know that I know God? Someone asked me that, and I thought a long time about it. How do I know that I know God? How do I come to the assurance that it's really God who is speaking to me? The consistency of the Bible, the first point, Acts 17 verse 12, is very important. The evidence in reality, Romans 1-3, should be very clear to me. But now, what is my final assurance that I really know God? Now, I would like to know your answer later on if someone would ask you. What would you answer on that? Now, my answer would be, I know that I know God not because I build up with my human reason first what I explained already, a certain standard of what God should be, and now I read the Bible and yes, it fits. This is not the way I know God. But I would say it is just the opposite around. Once I read the scriptures or listen to the word of God, I hear someone speaking to me. And I hear someone speaking to me who knows me by name and who knows who I am. To put it in Paul's words, it is the fact that I am known. I think that is what gives me the assurance that it is God speaking to me. And I would like to read that from 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1-3. In 1 Corinthians 8, it is on the problem of length of knowledge. 1 Corinthians 8, verse 1-3. And there Paul talks against all these people that say, we have knowledge. And he said, and it is in a situation where they had conflicts about food and whether you could eat food or not, a certain type of food offered to the idols. And then he is saying, we know that all of us possess knowledge. But knowledge puffs up. Love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he doesn't yet know as he ought to know. That is this knowledge that we build up with our own human reason. But if one loves God, one is known by him. Now this last statement is very short, summarized what we would need to say with more words. If I would say it with my own words, then Paul is saying, in reaction on the statement that many Christians make in Corinth, which is, we know God, then Paul is saying, when we say we know God, we haven't yet known as we should know, because each true knowledge of God is a love reaction on the fact that we are known by him. Now that you know God, Paul is saying in another place, in Galatians 4, verse 9, now that you have come to the knowledge of God, he is saying, or, and then he corrects himself, or rather, to be known by God, how can you turn back to the idols? Here again we see that Paul corrects himself and is saying, true knowledge of God is not proud knowledge that we have built up on whatever basis we have, but it is rather the opposite. It is God knowing us. And this is where God's revelation is self-evident. He who has come to know God in Christ and Christ crucified, he knows that he knows God, because he feels fully understood and he feels fully unmasked, and he knows himself to be judged and forgiven and sanctified and even glorified through Christ by the God of the universe. Now here alone is the final answer of all epistemology, the assurance of God's loving knowledge in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. Concluding, we can say, only a sound biblical epistemology can help us today to face the threatening questions of Freud and Feuerbach. And it consists of three layers, repeating myself. First, Acts 17, verse 12, the consistency of the scriptures as a miracle, as a wonder. How is that possible? Throughout the 14th century, one message of the one personal God acting through Israel and the covenant and revealing himself through Jesus Christ to save the world. And the second point, Romans 1-3, the evidences that indeed bring us to a real conviction of the truth, testing the scriptures to the universe that is there. But then thirdly, and most personal, 1 Corinthians 8 verse 3, the assurance that I am known by God through Jesus Christ. That leads me to the final certainty. You could say the calling of my name, as we read in the scriptures, for instance, in the meeting between Mary and Jesus. Mary and the risen Lord, where he said, Mary, and she answered, Rabbi. Now that's where I want to end this evening. We started with a garden in the jungle, and with people wondering whether there was a gardener. You remember, that's where we started. Indeed, if there would be only a garden in the midst of the jungle, we could imagine that these questions arise. But this is not where we stand. We stand in another garden, also in the midst of the jungle of history, of human history, the garden of Joseph of Arimathea, a garden in which there is an open grave, and where we are met by the risen Lord. Not the grass and the flowers can bring us into final assurance that God is there, but it's only the open grave and the risen Lord. That open grave can never be taken away out of our human history. And as we wonder, reading the scriptures, what that may mean, the risen Lord stands behind us, like with Mary. And it's he who calls our name. And it's only he who can break through the enchantment, as C.S. Lewis called it. The spell, the enchantment, which is, I think, the deepest secret behind this whole idea of projection.